Very strange to be introduced by Daryl. Feels very strange to be introduced in this place, but it feels good to be here. It's great to see so many familiar faces, so many familiar faces in a familiar place. And none of you are wanting an appointment. None of you are mad about an appointment. None of you are mad at your pastors. This is a good evening. I get to talk about something tonight that I don't know, honestly, I've ever spoken about publicly. I worked with Chadwick Stamper, and I think we decided the topic of my talk tonight is a Christian's view of, and I can't remember if we decide on Islam or radical Islam. The important thing to me in that topic was that it is a Christian's view. It's my view. It's a wide-ranging topic, a lot of emotion around the topic as we think about the worldwide religion of Islam. Some of the things I'll say tonight will shock some of you. Some of the things I'll say tonight may shock others of you. Where my interest in Islam comes from, obviously, is I'm kind of into religion in general, so that's obvious. I've traveled to Israel 6 times. Which, you know, there's a little situation going on there between Islam and Judaism. I've traveled once for several days in Turkey, which is completely Islamic. Traveled in Jordan one time, which is completely Islamic. The topic does fascinate me. I taught Islam once at a college. And I probably learned more than the students did as I was talking about Islam. I get the question pretty often, and we probably are all reflecting on the question as to whether or not Islam by nature perhaps can have stronger tendencies to violence than Christianity. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit, because I will probably shock some of you by saying my answer is going to be yes, and I'm going to offer you some reasons for that. I'm going to do 2 things tonight. I'm going to start out, I'm going to put the historian's hat on as I talk about the development of Christianity and the development of Islam and how we ended up being 2 very different kinds of religions. And then I'm going to end up with my Christian hat on, you know, with a little short discussion of now so what? You know, how do we treat people of another worldwide religion? There is a lot of ignorance that floats around out there. You know, for instance, I hear Christians disrespectfully speak of the word Allah. You need to keep in mind that, yeah, that is the Islamic word for God. That is the Arabic, because it's the Arabic word for God. But when you travel through the Middle East, Christians in the Middle East, you know, every time I take somebody to Israel, people seem to get real confused on this issue. Jews are Jews. Muslims are Muslims. So, what are the Christians in the Middle East? They're Arabs. They're Palestinians. So if you talk to a Christian in the Middle East who is an Arab or a Palestinian, guess what they call God?
Allah.
That's just the Arabic word for God. It's used by Arabs if Arabs happen to be Muslim. It's used by Arabs if those Arabs happen to be Christians. And, you know, we particularly in Israel, there's so much that's said about the Jewish versus the Palestinian or the Arab conflict that some of the people that get forgotten are the Christians in the Middle East. And again, the Christians are not Jewish. The Christians are not Muslim. The Christians that are indigenous to the area are Arab. So remember them. One of the things I hear frequently, too, is people assume if people are Arab, they're not Christian. And again, anybody in the Middle East that is Christian is Arab. They're not Jewish, they're Arab. Syria, for instance, is the site of one of the oldest branches of the Christian church. A lot of Christians in Syria. Those are not Muslims, simply only Muslims. They're dying in the Syrian conflict. A lot of Christians in Syria. A lot of Christians in Egypt, Coptic Christians, have a fairly strong presence in Egypt. So that really has nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about regarding what I think to be maybe, perhaps, a propensity in Islam that may lean a little more violent than what we have in Christianity. But just, you know, when you're speaking of Islam, you know, try to do it in an intelligent way. You know, I remember when people started talking about Syrian refugees coming to the United States. They just automatically assumed those were the folks that we need to blame for 9/11. Well, no, they may very well be Christian refugees coming to the United States. Anyway, so sometimes you just need to get your geography right. Islam is a religion. The largest ethnic group, this religion is not even, this Islamic is not Arab folk. What's the largest Muslim nation on the globe?
Indonesia
is the largest Muslim nation. So, you know, Muslims are not just Arabs, and all Arabs are not Muslim. A lot of Arabs are Christian in the Middle East. So let me put my historian hat on for a little bit. This is a discussion I've had over the years, one of two places, either internally with myself or with my son. Some of you know my son. My son is a politician. My son works in Raleigh. My son works for a think tank, a PAC. My son's views and my views don't always line up. And we have interesting discussions. We've done it for years. He has learned his political bent. He has learned his ability to debate, I think, from me. And he loves to debate. He will debate until I stop and walk away. But, you know, he and I particularly, a lot over the years, have talked about the Islamic world. Let me just offer you a historical vision. And if you get interested in this, I can give you a bibliography. This is not unique to me, but it's a view of Islam that I don't hear very often. Here's something really important for you to grasp. Islam and Christianity are different. You know, in America, we've got this thing going on that sort of says all opinions are created equal. That's not even respectful of opinions. Some opinions are right, some opinions are wrong. Just because you're sincere about something, you can be sincerely wrong about something. And a lot of people, particularly in the United States, when they speak of Islam, they almost paint it in Christian terms, which is almost disrespectful to Islam. Islam is Islam, Christianity is Christianity. If you make us all just a generic group of religious folk, you're being disrespectful to all of us. We all have our own distinctives, and Christianity is Christianity, and Islam is Islam. Then we do have some things in common. We're monotheistic, but we have some things, too, that are very different about us. The conviction I would offer you is that our origins and our history, in many ways, have created two rather different religions. So I'm going to require you to think a little bit tonight. Follow me. Let's start with the easier one. Let's start with Christianity. When Christianity was founded around the beginning of the Common Era, we spent about 300 years being the underdog, being the minority. We spent 300 years, sometimes not as often as people think, but sometimes being persecuted officially by the state. There were times Christians were thrown to the lions. There were official persecutions. What happened more often than not in the first 300 years of Christian history is that people just didn't understand us. You know, it might not have been an official government-sanctioned persecution, but our neighbors might have thrown a brick through the wall or a brick through the window. So we have 300 years of coming to age as a Christian movement in a culture like that. You know, we were on the receiving end of the Roman Empire's wrath. You know, all about Jesus' crucifixion. You know, every at least according to tradition, every Christian disciple of Jesus of the original 12, they all died a martyr's death, except which one?
John,
right. He's supposed to be the only one that died an old man in his bed. But all the others died a martyr's death. So we were developed in that age. And that's why particularly if you're the underdog, particularly if you're the one receiving the wrath of the establishment, if you're the one receiving the wrath of the culture, and you may know, this is fascinating, but I won't bore you with this. If you read the early Roman documents, we were accused of atheism by the general populace because we only had one God and we wouldn't worship all the gods of Rome. We were accused of incest. That's in the early Roman documents, you know, because we would get together and sometimes get together at night and we would call each other brother and sister. And then before you know it, we'd go home with our brother or our sister. And, you know, we were married to our brother and sister. We really confused people on that issue. We were accused of cannibalism in the early Roman documents. You can figure that one out. I mean, we would gather in what appeared to be almost secrecy and eat the body and drink the blood of this man, Jesus. So the culture around us had a really hard time understanding who we were when we first started. So it took 300 years, and I think it's a rather remarkable story, and I think it's a spirit-filled story, that after about 300 years, by 313, Emperor Constantine sort of embraced Christianity and tolerated Christianity. And by 381, everything else was outlawed except us. So we went from being a persecuted underdog, the object of the wrath of the state, to becoming the religion of the Roman Empire. It took us 300 years, though, to do that. So you might conceive, particularly because of the role that we would play in society, Jesus would say things to us like, love your enemies. He knew would have them. He said things like, turn the other cheek. Because again, he knew that we wouldn't have people coming at us. Go the extra mile. That is a direct allusion to a Roman law. A Roman soldier could conscript you to do whatever that Roman soldier said to do for 1 mile. They had mile markers throughout the Roman Empire. To go the extra mile means you would tell your Roman soldier, oppressor, that you would go the second mile. Which, by the way, that would really confuse the Roman soldiers. So we were told these things because we were the underdogs. All of the literature of the New Testament was penned by people on the underbelly of society, not the people in power. You with me? Think about where the New Testament comes from. Every author of the New Testament was on the underside, not in the position of power, but on the underside, the receiving of the wrath of those in power. Well, in a sense, we've been marked by that. You know, we've been marked by that. I mean, our sacred documents was marked by that. You know, that's why there's, you know, it's fascinating in one of the Petrine epistles, you're told in the New Testament to pray for the king, pray for the Caesar, which is fascinating when you stop to think. Probably the Caesar was not treating us well. You've seen the old cheesy movies in Hollywood of Roman soldiers and early Christians, things like Quo Vadis. There's some truth in that. Anyway, that marked our movement. That's also, you know, we've had periods in our history as Christians that, you know, the one everybody loves to mention is the Crusades. You know, the Crusades were not the best that Christianity had to offer. The Crusades is not something you really can support with the New Testament. The Old Testament, and keep, you need to know all this because I mean I'm turning to Islam. The Old Testament, we call the Old Testament, that doesn't thrill Jews. They prefer it's called the Hebrew Bible. We call the Old Testament the Old Testament, the New Testament the New Testament, because there is a sense that the New Testament has superseded the Old Testament. We decided in our earliest days as Christians to keep the Hebrew Bible, but it doesn't have the same standard as the New Testament. That's why even today, if you go to traditional churches like Roman Catholic, you will sit for the Old Testament, you'll sit for the Epistle, you will sit for the Psalter singing, but you'll stand out of respect for the Gospel. All Scripture in the Christian tradition is not created equal. You know that. The Gospels kind of have a little more bearing. That's why they were put first in the New Testament. They were written after Paul's stuff, but they were put first because of the importance of the Gospels. So the way we Christians use the Hebrew Bible in our better moments is we read the Hebrew Bible through Christian lens. We read the Hebrew Bible through the revelation of Jesus Christ. So in the Christian movement, we talk about progressive revelation. We talk about the importance of the historical revelation. God didn't dump everything in Genesis 1. You know, it's, you're kind of learning as you go. So the Hebrew Bible is still beneficial for us. The New Testament is the new improved version. That's particularly what Jews hear us say. And there's some truth to that, some truth to that. Keep in mind which came first. Now, you know, if we'd done it the other way around, and this is going to make sense in a moment, if we'd done it the other way around, where the Old Testament was the New Testament, and the New Testament was the Old Testament, only God knows what we'd be doing as Christians. I mean, I've read some of the stories in the Old Testament. But keep in mind, the Old Testament is the Old Testament, New Testament, New Testament. We read the Old Testament with a New Testament lens. You know, we don't really go out and slaughter all the Canaanites now. You know, we try to do this Jesus thing and read the Old Testament through New Testament lens. So keep in mind the order of Old Testament, New Testament. Keep in order the fact that we as Christians, for our first 300 years, we were the underdog, and our sacred text comes out of that. Now let me turn to Islam for a moment. Islam, because their sacred book, the Quran, they have loving verses, just like we have loving verses in the New Testament. Beautiful verses in the Quran. I've read the Quran. You know, Jesus is mentioned more in the Quran than Muhammad is. Hope you know that. Mary's mentioned in the Quran. All the Hebrew saints are mentioned, almost all of them are mentioned, many of them are mentioned in the Quran. The Quran also has sweet verses, kind verses, verses that command tolerance. But they also have the sword verses. You know, the ones that command the followers of Muhammad to slay the infidels. Let's talk a little bit, hold that in the back of your mind, because you need to say, well, when did that come in Islamic history? Keep in mind, in the 7th century, when Muhammad was doing his thing, when he was in Mecca, he was the underdog. Some of the Quran that comes from that period, his earlier period, some of the stuff that comes from the earlier period are some of the sweet, tolerant verses that American Muslims particularly like. That comes from the early Meccan period of Muhammad. But very quickly, Muhammad ran into conflict with the Jews and the pagan religions, the tribal religions on the Arabian Peninsula. So very quickly, Muhammad and the followers of Muhammad got involved in warfare. And that's when he ends up leaving Mecca and going to Medina. And some of his revelations came to him while he was in Medina. By the time he goes to Medina, he's bringing a war to Arabia. He and his followers are conquering Arabia. And it's the latter part of his revelations that are that contain things like the sword verse. Go look up chapter 9, verse 2, Surah 9, 2. That stuff comes late in Islam. The kind of verses in our Hebrew Bible that we should be very grateful to be able to relegate to the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, sort of form the New Testament for Islam. That was the final revelations of Muhammad. So keep in mind that when some of his scripture is being revealed through him, he's at a period where he's leading an army. He's at a period where he's conquering the Arabian Peninsula. He's at a period where he is becoming the power in Arabia. One of the things historians know well, if a document is written by people in power, that will be a very different document than is written by people who have no power. The Christian New Testament was written by people who had no power, other than spiritual power. The Quran, you know, regardless of how you feel like it came, but the period of the Quran, when the Quran was revealed to Muhammad or whatever, a big chunk of that period is coming out of a person, it's coming out of a movement that has the power, that's the upper dog, that's the one that's subjugating other people. Do you begin to get a feel how those two origins can create two different movements? At least kind of shake your head yes. I mean, it should make sense to you that a movement's coming out of those two kind of historical circumstances will create two different kinds of movements. Christianity also, in the West, Christianity has gone through, we were created as an underdog by people without the power, the societal power. We Christians also in the West, we went through the Enlightenment. You know what the Enlightenment is? That 17th, 18th century period where we all got really, everybody in the West got really excited about tolerance and democracy and the rights of all humanity, that finally gave birth to the French Revolution, that finally gave birth to all the democratic revolutions of the 19th century in Europe. Most of us are products of the Enlightenment, for good or for bad. I mean, we tend to think that all people are created. A good Enlightenment document is that one that says all people are created equal and have the right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, our founding fathers were all children of the Enlightenment. That's why a lot of them were deists. They all came out of that period where they were really fighting for the rights of humanity and to broaden those rights. Well, the Enlightenment pretty much did its work in Europe and consequently in the United States. That's why here in the United States, we've got things like separation of church and state. That's very much an Enlightened concept. Separation of church and state. I would contend that there is absolutely nothing in Islam akin to separation of church and state. Islam, I would almost contend that Islam is almost more of a political ideology than it is a religious ideology. Christianity, particularly post-Enlightened Christianity, we've kind of made Christianity all about personal religion. And Christianity does that well, by the way. But we've made Christianity a lot about personal religion. That's just not there in Islam. What does the word Islam mean? It means submission. From its earliest days, they thought all people should submit to their vision of God and the way society should be. That's what Islam means, submission. Christianity, again, because we started out as an underdog, we're a little shocked that we're a worldwide religion now and we have the power we have. And usually when we get power, it's not good for Christians. But Christianity just never had it. Islam started out wanting world domination. Muhammad started out that way. That's why by 1453, Constantinople falls. And not long after that, there was a big battle. There was a big battle not far from Constantinople. Thankfully, some of the European lords won, because if they had not, you'd probably have a crescent on top of this building right now. But Islam grew up in that sort of militaristic, conquering, even when Muhammad was alive, conquering environment. That creates two different strains. I contend that Islam in the East has not gone through an enlightenment. Now, that doesn't mean they're not intelligent. Some of the greatest science, some of the best preservation of Aristotle happened in the Islamic world. Brilliant people. But that was all kind of high Middle Ages as opposed to the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment really was a European and American thing. I used to kind of argue with my son, maybe Islam is 500 years behind us, and if we can give them another 500 years and we can give them an Enlightenment, to where our enlightened Western values become important to them, then that will sort of change. That's probably enough. I think the two movements, the two religions, are birthed in such different contexts. I think the two religions, our sacred text, what comes latter in their sacred text is frightening. I like the early sacred texts in the Quran are much more comforting to me. That's when Muhammad was still in Mecca and was living with Jews and Arab tribal religious people. But it's that latter stuff, and I'm hesitant to say the mature Quran, but it's that latter part of the Quran is where you find the sword verses. Okay, I think that's just some historical fact. I mean, that's just the two movements were birthed. And, just like with an individual, none of us are just at the mercy of our environment. None of us are just the product of our past. But our environment, our past, has a lot to do with who we are. And when you look at the history in the past of Christianity, I mean, there have been times we have been horrid. I mean, you know, it was the good German Lutherans that brought about the Holocaust. You know, but I think some of the times when we've been horrid, we still had to deal with turn the other cheek kind of verses, because they're all over them. I mean, we have the Sermon on the Mount, you can't miss it. But I think we've had two different historical developments, particularly from the earliest days. I'm fine with Islam and Christianity being different. We are different faiths. I think, and this is me, and this would be highly controversial in some places, I think that Islam, in general, is more prone to violence than we are. Now, it's just like my wife's mother's family, they're all prone to alcoholism. They just are. Some of them have succumbed to it, some of them not. So when I say they're prone to alcoholism, I'm not saying they're bad people. I'm not saying they have to give in to it. Particularly the Muslims in America are more, I think, enlightened than some of the Muslims I've experienced in Jordan and Turkey. In America, it's a different kind of culture they're living in here. So, you know, to say I think they're more prone to violence doesn't mean they're all horrible people, and there's nothing good in the faith. But I think their history has more easily set them on that trajectory. So now, as a Christian, what do I do with that? Well, you know, crusades is not an option for me, because I've heard Jesus. Using power like sometimes Muhammad or Islamic world has used power really is not an option for us. I've heard Jesus. I've read the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. This Jesus thing is really important to us. So however we respond, how do we respond to evil or Islam? And I'm not saying Islam's evil, but however we respond to anything has to be from a Christian perspective. You know, if somebody from a different perspective from ours leads us to respond in a way that denies the fact we're Christ followers, we've lost. We've lost. We've got to respond in a way that's Christ followers. I mean, the only option we have, the tools of the Christian community, the weapons of the Christian community, and you've read Paul, you've read Ephesians 6, the weapons of the Christian community are things like faith, prayer, love. Those are our tools. And I still contend, you may think I'm very idealistic, I still contend that those tools are strong enough to conquer the world. And we don't need to succumb to whatever pressures are out there to try to exert power in the way the world defines power. So regardless of how you define something or how you view something historically, then you have to make the decision, how do I respond to that? And, you know, and I think in a group like this, that should be obvious. We know what it means to be a Christ follower. We know what it means to turn the other cheek. I really have a hard time in my mind reconciling following Jesus with a preemptive strike on an enemy. I just do. Another topic for another evening would be the whole just war theory. We Christians, from Augustine through the Middle Ages, we've had a just war theory. When we said, okay, there are times to go to war. What is a just war? And we've kind of tried to define that over the years, and some people are more fond of a just war theory than others. Preemptive strikes on somebody can nowhere be in a just war theory. So, I mean, we still have to, if we're Christian, what we support kind of has to somehow factor Jesus in. When my laptop comes up every morning in the district office, this may say something more than just about my laptop, is what my background is for my laptop when it comes up is the icon that was produced a while back that shows those, is it 21 people who were beheaded by ISIS on the shores of the Mediterranean in Libya? There's an icon now produced, because those were all Christian. They were all Coptic Christians. And there's a beautiful icon that's produced now. It shows all 21 of them kneeling down. It shows the angels coming after them. It shows them wearing their, it's a beautiful piece of artwork. It shows them wearing the orange, and you've seen the pictures. It shows them wearing the orange of their prison outfits, but also shows them wearing stoles of red, showing that they're covered in the blood of Christ. You see the angels coming, bringing the crowns. To those 21 martyrs. That's what I have pop up on my laptop every morning, because that helps me keep my issues in perspective. You know, and my issues are, you know, the preacher made the wrong person mad last week. Well, when I look at these martyrs there from Libya, it reminds me, yeah, we got it pretty easy here. You know, and it's amazing. There are very few churches I go into. Where I hear a prayer lifted for all the persecuted Christians in the world. And you're in an age right now where there are more people being persecuted for their faith. There are more Christian martyrs being produced in our age than any other age of Christian history. And you wouldn't notice that listening to the prayer concerns in the churches that I go to. So I think it's an issue. We need to know how to address, you know, an enemy to us and to our faith. We need to make sure that our enemies help us become better Christians, not help us act like them. And again, I don't see the Islamic world as my enemy. I certainly see some of them as my enemy. I mean, ISIS. You know, there was a wonderful documentary on CNN, not on CNN, MSNBC, which is not, you know, a conservative bastion. There, CSNBC, MSNBC ran an article recently on the ISIS and the internet, showing the masterful job they're doing at recruiting. And they have recruited over 30,000 people is their number. They have recruited 30,000 people who have left Europe and America to go fight for ISIS. And these are top-notch internet movies, recruitment tools that's out there recruiting people to go fight for ISIS. Anyway, that's probably more than you ever wanted me to chat about. I would love some questions. Oh, I will quit. I told my wife I'd be home by about 8:30. Where are you at? Anyway, so, but I'm, what time do you want me to quit? I haven't got to talk in a long time, Daryl.
I don't know. Are we in anybody's nap time yet?
Not yet.
Just 5 minutes. Any just burning question. I love dialogue. I've walked into rooms of 200 people that were mad at me and God in the Methodist Church and just had a wonderful time having a dialogue. So I enjoy dialogues, yes.
You talked about the sword portion of the Quran. Go into more detail on that. Explain that to us.
If you just go Google sword verses, those are the verses that, and we have really more in the Old Testament for us, things like the slaughter of the Canaanites. We have stuff like that. What's called the sword verses, like Surah 9:2, that just says, kill the infidels. Kill those that don't believe in Allah. And those are the verses. You know, what people will try to say, and I guess it's what I was trying to say, what people will try to say, well, we all have, as Phyllis Tickle called it, text of terror in our sacred text. We do. I don't find them in the New Testament for us. For us, it's stuff in the Old Testament. In the Quran, it's not just relegated to the earliest period. They're actually coming from the latter period. But they see their Bible differently. All of the Quran is equal in Islam. As a matter of fact, unless it is the Arabic, it's not really the Quran. A translation, they're very different from us. You know, we can translate the Bible and it's still a Bible. If we translate it from Hebrew and Greek into English, it's still a Bible. But in the Islamic world, for it to really be the Quran, it has to be in Arabic. But so they really do give equal weight to all their verses. We Christians are not caught in that same trap. We don't have to say that Leviticus 18 is as important as 1 Corinthians 13 or our gospel text. But Islam does. Islam will not say that one verse is more important. One verse comes from the more mature Muhammad. One verse is an Old Testament, one verse is a New Testament. But the sword verse, you can Google them because there's a lot there. But it's just the verses that say horrible things about what you do to your enemies. And where we are defined, the dhimmis, are the people of the book, Jews and Christians. We are tolerated in the Quran, and we have been tolerated in Islamic cultures, But what the Quran teaches, what Islamic cultures teach, is we're tolerated as long as we still submit to the superiority of Islam, and we're tolerated as long as we economically support the Islamic nation or the Islamic kingdom. Anyway, there's verses throughout the Quran. Those are the sword verses, and it means sword because of violence.
I found it interesting and kind of difficult when I read it. The way they set it up with all of the longer chapters and the decreasing size of chapter, not chronological at all. So when you read it, it gets real confusing. Mm-hmm. You don't know where it's coming from. You have to go back and find a commentary to explain, you know, how this came later.
Yeah, he's talking about just how confusing the Quran is. If you do read it, it's kind of confusing because it is a series of revelations that the Muhammad. It's not the stories like we're used to in our sacred text. There are some stories there, though.
Before the war started in Syria, would you have a percentage of Christians in Syria?
Percentage of Christians. No, somebody needs to Google it. I'm not sure what the percentage of Christians are.
I mean, is it like close to 50 or 40?
I would guess 40%.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sort of interesting.
Because of all the Middle Eastern countries, Syria is probably one of the most historic. In the early days of the Christian church, as soon as the church left Jerusalem, the next center of, and you see this in the book of Acts, the next center of the Christian movement was Antioch, which was in Syria. So Syria was early a Christian movement. You know, when some things, you know, you see in the book of Acts even, some success happening there that was not happening in Jerusalem and around Jerusalem. But yeah, somebody can Google it and see. I'm not sure what the percentage of Christians are in Syria, but it's pretty high, or it was one time.
Since Muhammad had uprooted to today, has there ever been a precedent set where they use the Quran as its source, as its driving source, for having such a violent approach to non-Muslims? And I mean, nobody really knows necessarily the motivation of these people, but one sense that they
oh yeah, I mean, if you watch stuff like what was on MSNBC, and you can go to your computer and Google ISIS. If you look at some of the ISIS recruiting films, some of the ISIS recruiting videos, they're clear. To be a good Muslim, this is what you need to do. No. I know that's not popular to say, but yeah, there's. You're talking about other religions?
Or by Muslims. I'm sure it's used by other religions.
Yeah.
Muslim.
I mean, you have Genghis Khan was Muslim. You know, in the Mongol Empire.
Suleiman
the Magnificent.
So we've been here before.
Oh, yeah, we've been here before. We've been here before. And that's why I'm saying I think the roots are deeper there. There's a propensity there that's really not in New Testament Christianity. New Testament Christianity, we produce pacifists. You will not find a hardcore Muslim who's a pacifist.
And that's where I was going to get to. I'm disillusioned by, I don't see Islam adopting the Western values of human rights, and specifically gender equality.
No, I mean, again, if you look at the ISIS recruitment videos, which are scary, it's all about how to be a good Muslim and the evil of the West.
Well, that's ISIS, though, but there are nations of more modern.
Oh, yeah, even the moderate countries.
What about the madrasas that are in Saudi Arabia that created
by the Sunni? Yeah, I mean, it's not just ISIS, yeah, you're right. ISIS is the most extreme, but
Saudi Arabia is one of the more conservative Islamic nations. Indonesia, there's a couple other nations.
I felt a Jordan, by the way. I felt very different Jordan than, let's say, Turkey. Jordan, I actually heard King Hussein speak in Jordan when I was there. And he was talking about how, this goes back a little ways, he was talking about how Al-Qaeda was a bigger threat to them. Because Al-Qaeda doesn't consider people places like Jordan, who has embraced some Western roots. King Hussein was educated in England. They are almost more the target of radical Islam because they are not being good Muslims.
Right. Assimilation in Western values possible?
of grace of God.
Yeah, I mean, if they become, this is me, I'm going to be honest with you, if they become more American than Muslim.
I had a really interesting experience. I was doing business for 15 years with a Palestinian who got displaced from the Western Bank in the 67 Gulf War. I mean, the actual 67 Arab-Israeli War, he got, his family got displaced. They moved to Kuwait. He has now been an American citizen for 20 years. And interestingly, when the Palestinians were dispersed from the West Bank, when he went to Kuwait, they were treated like just second-class citizens. They came to America, became American citizens, and immediately were received back in Kuwait as the greatest. You're now American citizens. But his, I've had, for 15 years, I had conversations with him about this. He does not like America. He has lived, he has really improved his lifestyle, he's improved his income, but he's very angry that America has westernized his wife and children.
Well, I mean, the Enlightenment really did happen in the West.
That's my concern.
The Enlightenment really did, didn't happen in the East. The Enlightenment, for better or for worse, and there are Christians who bemoan the Enlightenment. You know, everything from biblical critical methods. The Enlightenment happened in the West. It did not happen in the East. You know, it's two very different cultures. You'll notice in Israel a lot of times it's things like discotheques or it's Ben Yehuda Street in Jerusalem that gets bombed because those are just blatant Western youth hangouts. And they're some of the ones places that get bombed because they just see the West, post-enlightened West particularly, as just being very decadent. There's days I agree with them, but in, by and large, the Enlightenment, I'm sort of grateful for. That's enough. Y'all need to tell jokes or something lighter than this. Go home on.
Let's give Jeff a round of applause.